Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is February the 7th. We're in Senate Finance Committee meeting. It is a couple of minutes after 9 a.m., joined by Chairman Stedman. Chairman Olson is still excused. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk. Just a special moment here. Will Bree Wiley stand? Could you keep your remarks to under 5 minutes? We want to recognize you today because you're receiving your 20-year pin. Keep it under 5 minutes, please. Thank you. You're very welcome. Just a note, just a few years to catch up to me. Today we're going to have on the agenda savings, reserves, and investment fund presentation from the Department of Revenue. Joining us is Commissioner of Revenue Adam Crum. Can you come forward and any other support that you want to be with you for this presentation? Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Very happy to be here today to present to the committee the standing of the state savings and investment accounts. This last year was just tremendous performance for the Treasury Division. I'll highlight a few of the key points before Chief Investment Officer Zach Hanna will actually go into more detail. At fiscal year 2024 close, $9 billion of funds in assorted investment accounts gained $580 million, with long-term funds gaining more than 13%. Alaska Retirement Management Board assets gained $2.8 billion, growing to over $43 billion with 9% returns, exceeding actuarial expectations. And another very important function of Treasury is the daily cash management of state operations, which we'll present in great detail. So with that, I'll pass it off to Treasury Division Director Pam Leary.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pam Leary. I'm the Director of the Treasury Division.
Before you get started, I'd like to recognize that Senator Giesel has been in the audience since we've been here. Welcome.
Thank you. On slide two, we're going to start off with our agenda. We're going to introduce you to the teams in Treasury, and then we will do a deeper dive into the cash management and investment functions. Slide four is a chart that shows the four sections in the Treasury Division that touch investments and cash flows. We have 40 professionals that work in these sections with strong longevity. In fact, Treasury leadership has an average of 16 years at the Treasury. Many of our staff have professional designations, such as CFAs, Chartered Financial Analysts, like CIO Hannah, and CPAs, Certified Public Accountants, like me. Managing $50 billion in numerous investment funds and tracking cash flows is as complex as it sounds. And I would like to take the opportunity first to acknowledge our very skilled and cohesive team for the work that they've done and will continue to do so. The box in red shows the portfolio management team, also called the front office, where 16 investment staff invest the assets for state fiduciaries. The team performs or oversees 80,000 trades annually, develops asset allocations and investment policies on behalf of hundreds of state accounts that roll into 45 investment funds, utilizing 30 investment pools, supported by about 130 investment managers and over 600 private equity funds. That is a lot, and about half of the assets are managed internally. You will hear more about the investment process from CIO Hannah a bit later. The green box is the accounting and operations side of the house, also referred to as the back office, which ensures that those 80,000 trades and all of the costs are directed and accounted for in the correct amounts and in the right funds. Excuse me. The purple box in the lower left is our middle office, where compliance and performance reporting is housed. The compliance group helps protect invested assets by monitoring adherence to existing laws, rules, regulations, contracts, policies, and guidelines. They perform more than 75 compliance tests on trades daily. The performance group calculates performance for 45 funds every day. This group also supports the other sections as the data management center, bringing technology into our practice to make us more efficient and knowledgeable. Cash management in the teal-colored box processes over 100,000 transactions annually that support the revenue and expenditures in the accounting system. They oversee all the cash flows into and out of the state and ensure that the general fund has sufficient balances to pay our bills. They coordinate with the investment team daily to maximize our invested cash amounts. They're also responsible for ensuring that federal reimbursements come into the state, which means they were quite busy last week when federal payments were set to pause. So those are the four sections of the Treasury that deal with investments and cash. And we're going to move on to slide six to talk about cash management. Cash management provides more core services to the state, from maintaining bank contracts for depository services and credit card acceptance programs to working with departments on federal programs. But arguably, the most important daily task that they have is to manage the state's cash flows. As the graphic on the right shows, cash inflows come from tax revenue, federal programs, agency receipts, and reserves, while cash outflows are made to pay payroll, pensions, Medicaid, and permanent fund dividends, to name a few. As I will discuss later, the cash management team is experienced in working with the state reserves to ensure we have sufficient cash balances to pay our bills. According to the Pew Trust Research, Alaska's primary rainy day fund, the Constitutional Reserve Budget, or CBRF, was the second highest of all states in terms of being able to cover our operating budget. With the passage of SB 26 starting in 2019, revenue began coming into the Treasury from the Earnings Reserve Fund managed at the Alaska Permanent Fund. And this has allowed for fewer draws from the Rainy Day Fund and another tool to manage cash flows, especially with the uncertainty surrounding the amount and timing of cash flows. On slide seven.
Senator Stedman, before you proceed with your question, we've been joined by Senator Yount, who's in the audience. He came in a couple of minutes ago. Okay. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's reference that we had one of the largest cushion accounts in the CBR in the nation, but don't we also have one of the most volatile revenue streams when we're geared into the price of oil versus property tax and sales tax and income tax and what other states have?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is true. Oil volatility and in some of the states that have higher reserves is a correlation that the Pew Trust identifies as one of the key reasons to have higher balances in rainy day funds.
Senator Stedman?
No, that was...
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
On slide seven, we have detailed why we have revenue and expenditure uncertainty. To Senator Stedman's point, unrestricted general fund revenue comes from two main sources now, oil and investment earnings. Oil is a commodity and quite volatile, but both in terms of price and quantity. And the revenue from the permanent fund investments is much less volatile due to the POMV, or percentage of market value, formula that provides certainty in the current and the next fiscal year. Further, because investments are providing a greater share of unrestricted general fund revenue, which is projected to be about 60% in fiscal year 2025, we have a bit more certainty with revenues, at least in the short term. While expenditures are generally planned, there can be uncertainty in terms of amounts and timings, and these fall into a couple of categories. Most federal programs require expenditures before reimbursement, so there's always money going out the door before it's coming in. Also, there tend to be larger appropriations that occur at the start of the fiscal year, so funds need to be available for those. Slide eight. defines cash flow deficiencies and revenue shortfalls and how we deal with them. Over time, as more and more subfunds were created, the general fund proper had less money in it to pay our bills. This resulted in the need to monitor our cash balances even more closely. Cash flow deficiencies are common and can be addressed by managing the timing of receipts and payments. An example of this is when we spread out appropriation payments across the year rather than transferring funds at the beginning of the year. There is a memorandum of understanding that's between the Departments of Revenue, Administration, OMB, and Law that outlines the steps that we follow, shown on the right-hand side of the slide. These are taken if we anticipate a cash deficiency, which is currently defined as forecasting cash, dipping below $400 million for 4 to 5 days. This is remedied by taking or borrowing from the earnings reserve or the budget reserves. A revenue shortfall differs from a cash flow timing deficiency. Still back on slide. A revenue shortfall differs from a cash flow timing deficiency. A revenue shortfall occurs when revenue is insufficient to cover general fund appropriations in any given year. The legislature generally includes language annually in the operating budget, which appropriates budget reserve funds for revenue shortfalls, and we have relied on this appropriation to authorize use of the budget reserve funds to address both revenue shortfalls and cash flow timing mismatches. The constitutional budget reserve has been used to cover revenue shortfalls historically, although the SBR reserve, the statutory budget reserve fund, has also been used. Moving to slide 9.
Senator Stedman.
Maybe for those watching at home, we could clarify what we're talking about when we throw out all the acronyms and the different vote levels so people can follow it. And then when we talk about needing the cash and borrowing, are we borrowing 24 hours or 6 months or 6 years? Or could you give us some parameters on that and help us understand the shortfalls and in the event you have to access the earnings reserve?
Ms. Leary.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So the constitutional budget reserve, we'll go into a little bit more detail later in the presentation about that fund. But it requires a three-quarter vote to access the money. We have, in times of positive revenue years, added to that balance. But recently, we've had deficits, and we have taken from the constitutional budget reserve to fill those budget shortfalls. It is called a borrowing because we must repay the CBRF balance up to where it was before we started taking money from it. And I believe the amount owed at this point is somewhere between $10 and $11 billion.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, that's helpful for those watching at home. There's no interest or time frame on that, but I probably garbled up my question. So if you run short of cash, you fall back to the CBR or the earnings reserve, and we're looking at a operating budget with a one-year time frame. So when you look at borrowing, how long of a time frame would that normally entail on your operations? Not filling the structural deficit, pulling it out of the constitutional budget reserve, but the day-to-day, month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter management of the state.
Ms. Leary?
Through the chair, I'll address the earnings, Senator Stedman, the earnings reserve account. It is now our primary tool in addressing cash deficits. We have borrowed from the CBR primarily because we saw that we'd have a short period of time where we would need cash, but that really has only happened once in the last probably 4 or 5 years, and that lasted for about a month. our primary draw is from the earnings reserve, and that has allowed for us to have to maintain our cash balances.
Senator Stedman.
No, I think that's helpful. But so what you're telling the community is when you run short, you can go to the CBR, but you're only going to go there for a week, 2 weeks, or a month until revenues catch up to your expenditures, and then you pay it back. So we're not accumulating debt throughout the year. The accumulated debt comes when we, as a legislative body, have to backfill the deficit.
Mr.
Commissioner.
Thank you, sir. For the record, Commissioner Crum, through the chair, Senator Stedman. That is correct, sir. The intent on the short-term cash borrowing from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, if it does come to that, is that full intent to repay that by the end of the fiscal year so we don't have cross-fiscal year issues. If there is a structural deficit that is anticipated, our process that we've agreed to with the Office of Management and Budget, the Department of Administration, as well as Department of Law, is that we would reach out through the governor's office to actually work with the legislature for some legislative action towards that. And so we are not trying to accumulate debt from the CBR on a cash borrowing basis.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Ms. Leary, please proceed.
We'll move on to slide 9. The chart on the right shows forecasted and actual cash for the first half of this fiscal year. The chart is updated daily after the cash management team works with departments and analyzes all anticipated payments and incoming revenue and any changes that they expect to the forecast. For example, if the tax department division knows its oil revenue forecast is going to change, they alert us so we can update our cash forecast. Or like in July 2020, when there was a decision to pay permanent fund dividends earlier than planned occurred, we then updated our schedule and made some changes to our cash draws. Sometimes we are anticipating funds that don't or won't be coming in, such as when the federal government announced it was going to shut down certain payments. The cash management team has to be responsive and able to readily react to these scenarios. Now that the earnings reserve account is our primary tool in addressing cash deficits, at the start of each year, we create an expected earnings reserve account draw schedule with APFC based on our forecasts. The schedule seeks to manage as close to the $400 million threshold to maximize investments of the ERA, and we have increased the number of draws over the years to provide greater flexibility and known liquidity needs. Including this year, we will have made 50 draws from the earnings reserve account, totaling $22 billion over 7 years, and have only had to provide revised schedules a couple of times per year due to unknown circumstances.
Mr. Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for also clarification for all watching, when we say we're working against the earnings reserve, that is against the appropriated limit of the POMV set by the legislature. So as we work against that cap, we do time that and work very closely with the investment team at the Permanent Fund Corporation to make sure that we are timing this accordingly. It's a very close, good working relationship to make sure that we're maximizing when those cash occurs to make sure the state stays in balance, as well as you're getting exceeded investment returns at the Permanent Fund Corp by not pulling from a high-earning account into a just a cash equivalent.
Thank you, Commissioner Crum. Ms. Leary?
Again, for the record, Pam Leary. I will also add that to date, we have drawn 2.5 of the $3.6 billion. That's the POMV equivalent. And so we will have 4 more draws for the rest of this fiscal year to take the remaining balance of the ERA that we are supposed to have transferred.
So how does that work when we're anticipating a deficit in this fiscal year's budget?
Chair Hoffman, it will be determined what order we will take the draws from. Historically, when we've had deficits in the budget, we have taken from the Constitutional Budget Reserve first, not always. And so that's something that will be planned when the time comes.
And what happens if the legislature doesn't take action this year to fill the deficit for FY25?
Chair Hoffman, the deficit is scheduled to come out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Thank you.
The last item on the slide highlights the interim.
Can we back up a little bit? It is scheduled, but that draw amount around 200 million or less hasn't been approved by the legislature with a three-quarter vote. How is that addressed?
Through the chair, once the legislature finishes its work on the budget, we will be able to see what language is in the finalized budget to see if we have appropriations to borrow for the CBR on a temporary basis.
Senator Stedman.
I'm just trying to make sure the people at home can follow all this financial talk. So what happens if there's no three-quarter vote? Then what happens? If you run a deficit in a year, the SBR, statutory budget reserve, is empty. It takes a simple majority. That pushes us to the constitutional budget reserve that takes a three-quarter vote out of each body collectively, or actually individually, I guess, each body. What happens if you don't get that vote? And you run into June 30th on $50 million or $300 million. It doesn't really matter what the amount is. What happens?
Commissioner Crum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Commissioner Crum, through the chair to Senator Stedman. I greatly hope that we don't approach that, but as we look at, we're shooting for mid-March for our spring forecast update for the current year revenues. They have been up slightly, so hopefully that does cover the gap. But if this looks like it's going to be a pending issue throughout the rest of legislative session, we're going to have to dive into this very, very closely with the Office of Management and Budget and the Gov's office to actually keep the legislature informed of what is going on, as well as come up with a structural plan. The plan as far as if there is a structural deficit and what occurs, I do believe is an OMB and a Gov office decision from the cash management. We can only help manage the cash that is available, sir.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Help me with the term impoundment. And what is impoundment? When the appropriated amount for the budget is exceeded by the expenditures. What tools does the administration have under the impoundment clause to move forward?
Commissioner Crum.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman. I'm familiar with that term, but I actually don't know what our tools are on that, sir. We'll have to get back to the committee.
Ms. Hanna, do you have an answer to that? Or Ms. Leary?
Chair Hoffman, I do not.
I think it's a very critical question, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's appropriate answer. When they get a question they're uncomfortable with answering or want to double check, to get back to the committee, and I think that would be a good issue to get back to the committee on the impoundment clause and the tools that the administration has to continue the operation of critical components of the state.
Sir.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Ms. Leary, please proceed.
Thank you. The last item on this slide highlights the integration of our cash and investment teams. Every day, based on the forecasts and planned cash flows, cash management projects cash expected to be available for investment and works with the portfolio team to ensure that all expected funds are fully invested. Cash management is a small but mighty team with a big impact throughout the state, and they do a great job. So with that, I'd ask if there are any further questions.
Nope.
And if not, I'll turn it over to CIO Hanna to discuss the Treasury investment process and performance.
Mr. Hanna, please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Zach Hanna, Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. Go ahead and turn to page 11. So page 11 is a summary of the process that Treasury uses to set over 25 state investment policies and asset allocations. For 5 years, we've used a formal state investment review. This involves the commissioner, staff, and an independent investment advisory committee in a similar process to what we use for the retirement board. We review financial markets and performance for each fund quarterly. And at least annually, we review capital market assumptions and select asset classes for investment. And we go through each fund to set an appropriate investment policy and asset allocation that considers both fund objectives and fund constraints. Looking for more detailed investment policy information than what we will provide here today, the full quarterly investment review packets are available online, along with other Treasury fund information at the links provided on page 28 in the appendix to this packet. Page 12 has general capital market performance information. The past few years have been incredibly volatile, as everyone realizes. This period includes the pandemic, which led to high stimulus and near zero interest rates, followed by significant inflationary pressure, with inflation peaking at over 9% annualized in June of 2022. The Federal Reserve responded, with short-term interest rates increasing to over 5%, which was challenging for both stocks and bonds in 2022. But now inflation has come down to more reasonable levels, and in 2023 and 2024, capital markets have had a strong rebound. As you can see in the far right on the chart, which rank orders asset class returns each year, performance was all positive last year. This was led by 24% return in U.S. equities and on down the list through 5% returns for cash equivalents and more modest fixed income returns. So this is the backdrop for 2024 returns that we'll now go through by asset class and fund. Page 13 goes to the performance of the asset classes.
Before you proceed, we have a question from Senator Stedman.
You're speeding along so fast, I'm having trouble keeping up. Back on page 11. Can we get for those watching and stuff, can we get a definition of Jafonzi, what that actually is? And then Illinois Creek Mine Fund, that is something that hasn't been on the radar screen. Can you help me with what that is?
Mr. Hanna?
This is Director Larry. I'll respond to that question. We do talk about the individual slide funds a little bit later in the slides. But the Jafonzi is the general fund and other non-segregated funds. There are about 185 different funds. It's actually comprised of two separate funds. Have different asset allocations. The largest of those is the general fund proper that holds our cash, which is the checkbook of the state. The Illinois Mine Creek Fund is a fund that was created after the bankruptcy of the company that was working on the mine, and the money is held there for any kind of reclamation work that will need to be done in the future. I actually reached out to find out the status of that fund and use and plans. There was an analysis of the lands about 4 years ago. They intend to have another one. There are potentially parties interested in some of the claims up there.
It should be noted that in the past, the department was investing the Power Cost Equalization Fund, and the department, the legislature changed that and transferred that fund over to the permanent fund to manage. So that is the reason that this fund is no longer listed on the Treasury's investment funds. Please proceed.
Okay, so page 13, and I will try to slow down, goes through the performance of the asset classes that Treasury managed for non-retirement state portfolios through December of 2024. These are all commingled investments that are used in different proportions to construct portfolios that are diversified, low cost, and they all have high liquidity. We manage over 80% of this internally and focus on delivering market returns with consistent upside. The table on the right, the top section, has the total performance for each asset class the state funds invest in, followed by a section with benchmark performance, and then finally, performance relative to that benchmark. As you can see, returns were strong in that top section, with bond and cash returns ranging from 2 to 5.6%, and equities from 5 to 24%. Overall, these nominal returns added $575 million of income and gains to the state balance sheet in 2024. In the bottom relative section, the results were also strong overall. For state portfolios, most of the assets are in the first three categories, from cash through core fixed income. These are all internally managed by a treasury investment team that has produced consistent and increasing excess returns over time. And they had one of their best years ever in 2024, with excess returns from 34 to 70 basis points. And for clarity, a basis point is 1/100th of a percent, so 70 basis points is 0.7%. When you add it all up, total excess returns delivered by Treasury for internally managed portfolios across the state and Armboard assets added $130 million in additional value above benchmark returns last year. And if there aren't questions on asset class performance, let me hand it back to Director Leary to start going through the individual funds. We will then go back and forth as she provides the background and history for each fund, and I cover asset allocation and performance.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we spend a lot of time dealing with issues, problems here. It's not too often we actually have successful stuff that we get to talk about. So I think this is one of those times. I think the Treasury Department has done very well, and we certainly appreciate it when revenue is getting tight that the performance is stellar. And I think Treasury should take their time when they go through here and beat their chest a little bit, because it's kind of nice to have positive stuff at the table.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Commissioner Crum. Thank you for that, Senator Stedman. It is important to recognize that that excess returns above benchmark is a tremendous thing. That's that alpha generation that because of the work that the staff did, we do that at a lower basis point management fee, is actually generating additional value to the state. So that extra $130 million of value added to this on top of the other gains is pretty tremendous. And it's a lot of work that has gone into this. The team that has been built there and pretty steady across the board is something that is absolutely worthwhile, and I think Alaskans should be very proud of, particularly when you look at the market as a whole. It's one thing to make it in a bull market. It's another thing to make it on top of that additionally. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Mr. Hanna. Ms. Leary.
Chair Hoffman, thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about the individual funds now. And on slide 15, we will discuss the savings reserve funds. The blue part of the chart shows the fiscal year-end balances of the main fund of the CBRF, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. The fund was created in the Constitution in 1990 when voters approved adding Section 17 to Article 9 of the Constitution of the state. And all money received by the state after July 1, 1990, through resolution of disputes about the amount of certain mineral-related income must be deposited into the CBRF. The orange area of the chart shows the amounts of the subaccount of the CBRF, which the legislature created in 2000. In accordance with statute, money in the subaccount shall be invested to yield higher returns than in the main fund, and is used for funds that will not be needed for at least 5 years. In 2008, $4.1 billion was deposited into the subaccount and was managed to achieve a higher return than the main fund. In April 2015, the balance was returned to the main fund when it was determined the fund would be needed within 5 years. And as we mentioned earlier, appropriations from the CBR do require a three-quarter vote unless certain conditions are met. The yellow area represents the statutory budget reserve, which was created in 1986. The SBRF was a part of the Jafonzi funds, which we'll talk about, before and after being managed as a separate fund from 2013 to 2015, but we're showing it on this slide just to show all reserve funds so you can see how they have built over the years and then were used. And without any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hanna.
Senator Stedman.
Sure, again. What was the peak amount of the savings we had, and where are we at today on your chart?
17.6.
In 2014, through the chair, Senator Stedman, in 2014 we had $17.6 billion in all three of the reserve funds. And right now we have $2.8 billion currently.
Senator Stedman, we remember those days as we were there and put those funds away.
Yes, that is true. Mr. Chairman, I just thought it'd be nice to point it out for those that are watching, paying attention to what's going on here at the table, the significant savings that the legislature put away historically. Unfortunately, the rapid decline, and now there'll be numerous meetings and conversations of how we don't collapse the rest of the savings to keep the state operating.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Hanna.
Thank you. The CBRF main account is on page 15. The fund has a potentially short time horizon and needs principal protection and high liquidity since it is the key state emergency reserve fund. It has had a stable balance close to $3 billion the past 2 years, but was drawn down to $1 billion the prior 3 years through the pandemic. It's currently invested 100% in cash equivalents, but this is not typical. It was originally de-risked due to the pandemic drawdowns, but exiting this period, staff has intentionally left this fund positioned in shorter maturity investments due to the combination of high yield and low risk when compared to longer maturities. This position has been accretive to returns over the past 3 years since cash equivalents have outperformed core bonds by 600 basis points, so that's 6%. But over the longer term, the CBRF main account has more typically had considerable longer bond exposure and at times some equity exposure. And Treasury will likely recommend transitioning the fund back towards a higher but still moderate risk posture when rates normalize to maximize returns. From a performance perspective, 2024 was a great year for the CBRF, despite the modest decrease in short-term interest rates in the second half of the year. The one-year performance was 5.59%, in excess of the benchmark by 34 basis points. In total, this resulted in $150 million in gains for the CBRF in 2024.
Please proceed, Ms. Leary.
Director Leary, again for the record. Moving to slide 17, here is the Jafonzi slide, and it's the general fund and other non-segregated investments. As I mentioned earlier, the general fund itself is the checking account of the state where all cash flows come into and out of and where we keep a minimum floor of $400 million. In addition, there are about 185 other accounts and funds that have assets in the two Jafonzi accounts that are managed together but accounted for separately. The first Jafonzi was created in 1992 as a way to pool accounts for investments, and the Jafonzi 2 was created in 2018 to target a higher risk return for a subset of those funds. As of June 30th, there was $3.7 billion in the Jafonzi funds combined. And we've also included an appendix in the presentation on slide 27 that lists the top 30 funds that roll into both of the Jafonzi funds with balances as of December 31st, 2024. The general fund proper is the largest of these funds at close to $1 billion.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Jafonzi funds back, and your, I guess it goes up to page 27, showing the statutory budget reserve fund of $224 million. Can I spend that money in this year's budget? Could you help me with that? Because there's
through the
some
chair,
folks that think
Senator
that.
Stedman.
Ms. Leary.
Thank you. There are cash balances in the statutory budget fund currently. They are earmarked to be spent and used for fiscal year 2024 expenses. Typically, what we see is at the end of any fiscal year, the Division of Finance goes through all of the accounting records and will move the remaining balances, such as the SBR, into where its use is supposed to be for the year. It is anticipated to be zero on the balance sheet and in the budget. And here is where we get into definitional issues between balances. We report on the actual cash balances that we have at the state, whereas the budget and our comprehensive financial statements at the end of the year are based on an accrual method.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason I ask that, there's some scuttlebutt in the building that this was unencumbered cash that we can put into this upcoming budget due to the confusion of the definitional process that you just had mentioned, and I just wanted to point that out. A lot of these funds aren't liquid because they are encumbered, and we need to find the unencumbered balances when we look at stuff, because there was some excitement in the building that some people thought they found a couple hundred million that they can spend.
Look elsewhere. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Hanna?
The record, CIO Hanna. So on page 18, both Jafonzi 1 and Jafonzi 2 have a short-term investment horizon with a relatively high need for principal and income protection. Jafonzi 1 is 85% cash equivalents and 15% short-term bonds. And Jafonzi 2 is a modestly higher risk posture with 61% cash equivalents, 33% short-term bonds, and 6% equities. And similar to the CBRF, these funds have fewer long-term bonds than they have had historically, which was intentional and has paid off. As rates normalize, you can expect to see some additional risk added to these funds to increase earnings while still protecting principal. Performance was good for the year for both. Jafonzi 1 had a return of 5.44% and Jafonzi 2 5.97%, both over 35 basis points in excess of their benchmarks. Overall, this total performance resulted in $180 million in gains during 2024 for the Jafonzi collection.
Ms. Hanna?
Again, Director Leary. Moving to slide 19, we see the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund historical balances. The fund was capitalized with a $400 million deposit from receipts of the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation, and it's used for paying Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards and Alaska Advantage Education Grants. Up to 7% can be appropriated for scholarships, and of that amount, two-thirds go to the Alaska Performance Scholarships and one-third to the Alaska Advantage Education Grants. HB 322 established the Higher Education Fund as a separate fund as of June 30th, 2022, and HB 148, passed last legislative session, increased the amounts of the scholarships and the grants.
Mr. Hanna.
For the record, CIO Hanna. So on page 20, we are now turning to funds that have a long time horizon and a high ability to bear risk. Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund is the first of these. We use a high risk profile for this fund to work to achieve the fund's spending objective up to 7% of the prior year's balance. We set the risk profile for this fund and others like it at the risk equivalent of 70% equities, 30% bonds. Performance over the past year was strong at 11.39%, 24 basis points in excess of the benchmark. And for the year, this resulted in $44 million in gains. And the 10-year performance was strong as well at 7.26% through a very volatile period.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question would be, if the expected 10-year return I see here is a little bit above 7%, and our target is to spend up to 7% a year, what's going to happen to that fund over the long term?
Mr. Hanna?
So through the Chair, Senator Keel. And so we don't chase risk with this fund. These long-term funds generally have a long-term asset allocation kind of set at 70% equities, 30% bonds. And so as capital market expectations change over time, the expected return coming from that asset allocation will go up and down over time. And so you can see, again, the expected return for the forward 10-year period as of last year when we did asset allocations was modestly in excess of that spending goal. But this fund, if you were to go back in time, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when interest rates were near zero, you know, this fund had an expected return that was well below 7%. So I think it was in the high 5% range, probably close to 6%. And so you will see that ebb and flow over time. The long-term returns have been in excess of 7%. And we do think it's a reasonable expectation that over the long term moving forward, the nominal return to this fund may well be in excess of 7%. But if it is not, you would see, so if it's not and the legislature decides to spend at exactly 7% over time, you would see the principal eroded as a result of that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said the nominal return is 7%. So I'll ask the question maybe with that in mind. If your assumptions are right and we spend 7%, what happens to the buying power of the fund over those 10 years?
Mr. Hanna.
Through the chair, Senator Keel. I think what you're alluding to, if the legislature does decide to spend at exactly 7%, and returns are over the long term exactly 7%, and inflation is above zero, you would expect that spending pattern to erode into the real value of the fund, the buying power of that fund over time.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like we probably don't have a this year emergency, but we have a long-term problem we the legislature are going to have to address unless you find a magic way to make 7% real return, which doesn't sound likely.
Yeah.
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Senator Keel, this is Commissioner Crum. To what you're getting at, sir, is the real rate of return would be the expected return minus the assumed capital, the inflation of 2.5%. So the real rate of return over time is about 5.7. And so, yes, the buying power would be decreasing of the total value of the fund over time. And so that is a conversation as we continue to monitor and present. We'll make sure that the legislature is aware of that and what happens. And as you see from the prior slide, the essentially stagnant value, and even on this with the market value, holding in that $400 million range, it is a decrease in buying power each year if it does not gain above that.
Thank you, Commissioner Crum. Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, I think when we take a look and have the discussion on the permanent fund, what we want to change, if anything, on that going forward, I think we should include this fund in the comparison along with the mental health trust fund, which draws out 4.25, permanent fund at 5, and this one at 7. So we can actually have three real funds we can lay side by side and visually see what happens over time with the erosion of the purchasing power, and have the discussion and the debate if we want lower payouts to protect the purchasing power going forward.
Along those lines, there has been discussion and recommendations by the Permanent Fund Board to collapse the funds into one. And has the administration considered following up on the Permanent Fund Board's recommendation and introduce legislation to do so?
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Commissioner Crum. At this time, sir, no, that has not been brought forward.
And what is the logic or the reason for not doing that? Does the administration feel that that is a bad idea?
Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Crum. It's actually something we haven't discussed in detail, but with some of the other large pending items that we're trying to address this legislative cycle, along with some of the revenue items that we're trying to monitor and look at.
And if that concept came forward, would the administration support that concept?
Mr. Chair, we have to evaluate that and talk internally with the Gov Office and Office of Management and Budget to look at what that exact proposal would be.
Maybe it's time for the legislature to come up with that concept and how that's being discussed, and I think Senator Giesel has been working on that, and that may be before this table sometime this session. Mr. Hanna. Senator Stedman? No. Mr. Hanna?
We're going to move on to slide 21. Here we see the historical asset values of the Public School Trust Fund, which ended fiscal year 2024 with $834 million. The fund has been around since 1978 and is funded by 0.5% of state receipts from the management of state lands, so mineral lease rentals and royalties. The fund is used to provide an offset to the K-12 formula funding for education. For fiscal year 24, the fund contributed $32 million to the Public Education Fund and is expected to contribute $35 million this year and next year.
Please proceed.
For the record, Sierra Hanna. So on page 22, the Public School Trust Fund also has a long time horizon. The fund is the same high risk profile as the Higher Education Fund. But as an interesting counterpoint to that fund, and perhaps a bit of a response to Co-Chair Stebbins' observation, Treasury also works to inflation-proof this fund over time through a combination of the investment policy and spending recommendations. And so we actually make a recommendation each year to the Department of Education and Early Development for what, you know, for how to expend this fund for the forward year. And we do some forward modeling in this fund, and that in conjunction with our expected earnings is focused on fully inflation-proofing this fund over a forward 20-year period. And so that was, I think, our recommendation last year was to spend at 4.8%, so very close to the 5% that is in statute, but modestly below because of that forward expectation. And that spending rate has fluctuated over time, our recommendation. Sometimes it is as high as 5%, and sometimes it has been lower. And so performance for this fund over the past year, again, was 11.39%, 24 basis points in excess of the benchmark. For the year, this resulted in $88 million in gains and brings the fund basically back to peak assets. And 10-year performance for this fund was 6.98%.
Please proceed.
Moving to slide 23, we have the assets of the pension and health defined benefit plans for the public employees retirement system, which is in blue, and teachers' retirement system, which is in orange. These four funds totaled $31 billion at the end of June 2024, and as closed funds, the defined benefit plans currently are experiencing net withdrawals annually from the funds. The fiduciary is the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and it's comprised of 9 trustees, 2 from the PERS system, 2 from the teacher system, 2 commissioners, 2 public representatives, and 1 finance officer. Zach will give you some updated results, but for fiscal year 2024, investment returns for these funds were just over 9.2%, and the 40-year return average for PERS and TERS was 8.96%, just under 9%, which compares favorably to the actuarial assumed rate, which is currently 7.25%.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. The other day we got a presentation from the administrator. They gave a very different long-term average, I think 120 basis points lower. Is there a difference in how you calculate, or did they just pick a different time period?
Yeah. Mr. Hanna.
Through the chair, Senator Keel. I can't comment to the number they provided, but there shouldn't be a difference. The numbers that we're quoting are from the board's consultant, Callan. They are the performance kind of book or record, and those are the performance numbers that everyone should be quoting. And so most likely it is just simply a different time period. And so our longest track record is 40 years now. And so when we talk about, you know, that long-term return, that's as far back as it goes. And so as you march forward in time, in general, and I've got lots of those different, you know, lots of different numbers there. They ebb and flow. Some of, you know, a 30-year number is 7.8%. 15-year number is 9.04%. You know, obviously the last fiscal year is 9.22%. And so likely it is just a difference in time frame. But we could follow up on that if you'd like.
Thank you. Senator Keel. Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Okay, so again, for the record, CEO Hanna. And so last on page 24 is Treasury's largest client. The state retirement systems represent 83% of Treasury assets under management. The systems have a more complex asset allocation since they are long-term funds with a long-term fiduciary board. They have meaningful allocations to less liquid alternative investments like private equity, private debt, and real assets. The current asset allocation is 43% public equities, 23% fixed income, and 34% alternative investments. The returns have been strong. Here we focus on longer-term returns since having material allocations to alternatives can make shorter-term comparisons difficult or misleading. The 10-year return through September 30th was 7.91%, 41 basis points over the benchmark, in excess of the actual expected return. Overall, excess returns have resulted in over $2 billion of additional value to the pension systems over the past 10 years. Performance is in the top third of returns when compared with peers, better than over 65% of other public pension systems. And part of this excess return can be attributed to the ARM Board's intentional low-cost approach that emphasizes internal management. This led to total costs that are roughly 30% lower than the median peer, saving over $30 million per year consistently. So overall, strong returns from the ARM Board have made a meaningful contribution to retirement assets and reduced the need for higher state contributions.
So those individuals that have the defined benefits contributions should feel very comfortable at this stage with this presentation. Please proceed.
So in last, slide 25 summarizes the investment results, most of which I've already mentioned. Direct and Leary are honored to work with a great team of professionals in Treasury. They take a lot of pride in managing a complex set of portfolios and generating strong results for the state. Overall performance for all the funds that Treasury manages resulted in an aggregate 9.1% return for the calendar year and $4.5 billion in total gains. And that concludes our presentation. We certainly appreciate your time and are happy to try to address any further questions.
Do any members of the Finance Committee have any questions of Commissioner Crum and his staff? Seeing none, Commissioner Crum, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Commissioner Crum. Just really grateful for the time to be here today. We'll make sure we follow up with the committee. But yes, as you'd mentioned, the state funds are in very good hands as the way they're managed. We have been able to actually exceed performance against both peers and benchmark. We'll continue to do this, and also at a very low cost. That is one of the important things that we try to do within Treasury is keep our management fees down, our internal cost basis. We have it in statute that we have to maximize risk-adjusted returns, and so we don't chase returns. We try to actually do this and try to get good, maximized returns at a very low risk basis in order to make sure that the stability of the funds is there for the long term, because that's the responsible thing to do with our public dollars.
Thank you, Commissioner. That concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting is going to be following the Super Bowl, and which will be Monday, so Monday the 10th. Go Eagles. We will be hearing the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation on Monday. So have a good weekend and enjoy the Eagles win.
Thank you.
That we are adjourned.